Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A return to heresy today, just one guest, someone who's been on this show many times before, Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis first appeared on Behind the News in 2008, discussing economic crisis and popular unrest in Greece. In the following years, he was on quite often, tracing the evolution of the euro crisis. It has been a few years, though, since he was last on the show. Too long. But here he is to make his case that we've moved beyond capitalism to something worse, techno-feudalism. I'll leave the definition to him. Before that, he'll talk about the experience of being banned in Germany for supporting the Palestinian cause, something that is now essentially illegal to do in Germany. Another frequent Behind the News guest, Jody Dean, has been suspended from teaching at Hobart and William Smith Colleges for writing a defense of Hamas on the Verso blog. This gross violation of academic freedom was undertaken, in the words of the college, for the safety of the students. Similar reasons were given by USC for canceling the valedictorian address by Osna Tabassum. Of course, her real crime was that she would have supported the Palestinian cause. This is quite the repressive crackdown. And now on to Yiannis Varoufakis. He is by profession an economist, but has a far broader range of interest than most members of that profession. He's just out with Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, published by Melville House. Yiannis Varoufakis. Let's start with what's going on in Germany. You are forbidden any political activity in Germany? How'd you cross the Teutonic authorities here?
Clearly, the divorce between the state of Germany and myself has to do with the manic and hysteric attempt by the Federal Republic and, you know, its whole political spectrum, it's not just the government, their manic attempt to essentially shed like a snake skin their own nationalism and to replace it by a very rabid version of Zionism. There is no other explanation of what is going on here. Because let's not forget that this is not aimed at me so much, Doug. Let me inform our listeners that on Friday morning, when the Palestine Congress was meant to take place in Berlin, which my political party in Germany, Mera 25 Deutschland, co-sponsored together with the Jewish Voice for Peace, the first arrest involved a young Jewish man who was holding a little placard that he had made himself saying Jews against genocide. And he was immediately arrested for that, for anti-Semitism. And when he asked the policeman in perfect German, because he is German, so would you have been okay if it said Jews in favor of genocide? Then he was beaten over the head by the police.
My God.
So this is, you know, banning me from entering the Federal Republic of Germany, besides the interesting repercussion that effectively they have declared the European Union to have been dissolved, because supposedly one of the great benefits of being in the European Union is that there is freedom of movement of persons, of ideas, of views. Well, that has been completely dissolved now, courtesy of the German government. But the main point is that a proud, a decent people, the German people, are yet again being dragged into complicity with a genocide which is perpetrated in their name without them actually realizing exactly what it is that their government has been doing. This is a first strike at the right of Jews in Germany to organize politically against political decisions by the Israeli state. So the way I understand it, and this is how I'm going to conclude this very long-winded answer to your brief question, I think the German establishment is absolutely adamant that they need, for their own reasons, to equate any objection to the policies and practices of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism. That is the raison d'etre. This is the reason for the state, as it is expressed through this farcical, banning me would be completely farcical if it wasn't so serious. And Doug, for the benefit of our listeners, they didn't just ban me from entering Germany, which they actually don't have the right to do because I'm a European citizen, as I mentioned. But beyond that, this is where we're entering Monty Python territory. They banned me from participating in any event in Germany via Zoom, via video link. And if that were not enough to demonstrate the levels of the comedy involved, they have banned anyone in Germany from replaying a recording of my voice or my face during any event, whatever the subject might be. You know, I have spent the last 30 years giving lectures in universities in Germany on economics, on this, on that, and the other. All that now has been banned simply because of this manic hysteria for identifying any opposition to whatever it is that Netanyahu's regime is doing in Israel, identifying this opposition with anti-Semitism.
How do you see this? I mean, is it just displaced guilt of the Holocaust? They're trying to, as I saw someone on Twitter say, you can't wash off your guilt over the Holocaust with the blood of Palestinians. Is that the mechanism that's underlying all this?
Well, it's partly that. I did allude before in my long-winded answer to my theory that after 1945 and the imperfect denazification, it was a denazification in name but not in content. Remember how many Nazis remained in positions of power after 1945? After that imperfect denazification, the German political system could not sustain a nationalist, not even a patriotic narrative. Even the word patriotism, which is fine by me, I'm a patriot, I'm a Greek patriot, I love my country, that's what I mean by that. In Germany, the German establishment cannot bring themselves to saying, to calling themselves patriotic. You can see that in the way they have embraced the European Union. Unlike the French elites, both of the right and the center-left, who saw the European Union as an opportunity to create a greater France, the German elites saw the European Union as an opportunity to lose themselves in the in Europeanism and Europeanness, and to shed their nationalism. But, and here is, this is my theory, right? I may be completely wrong. My theory is that in order to maintain an ideological glue that allows them to stick together, to replace the nationalist glue that they shed, well, they adopted Zionism.
Do you see this anywhere else in Europe? And the degree of, it seems more extreme in Germany than elsewhere in Europe. Certainly it's going on here as well, but the Germans really seem to be breaking new territory here. Are comparable things going on elsewhere, or is Germany really an outlier here?
No, it's not an outlier. I'll give you an example. Sometime in late October, I was meant to travel to Vienna, where I had been awarded a prize by the Academy of Sciences and Arts, and it was awarded to me 2 years ago. I was under a lot of pressure to go by the Academy of Sciences and Arts and to meet the president and to meet the ministers, and it was a great honor. And in the end, we delayed it because I was very busy with politics, with this, that, and the other. And I was, you know, a big event, a three-day event, actually, was scheduled for me. And I was, of course, disinvited. I was disinvited because I took the view that pretending that the problems in Israel-Palestine began on the 7th of October, that everything was hunky-dory until then, until Hamas attacked the wall and killed people and took hostages, is to fly in the face of reality and to denigrate the fact that for 80 years now, the Palestinian people have been subjected to ethnic cleansing, that Hamas is irrelevant, that was a point I made. And why is Hamas irrelevant? Because, well, to begin with, let's say that there was a button and we pressed it and Hamas disappeared. Well, would the problem be solved? No, because as we know, Hamas is almost non-existent in the West Bank, and yet settlers and the IDF are continuing the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians there. Making those statements after the 7th of October was deemed sufficient to disinvite me from Vienna. Similarly, here in my own country, which was traditionally a country that found a lot in common with the Palestinian cause. Let me tell you that up until the 1990s, the Greek governments, the right-wing governments, we have mostly right-wing governments up until the 1990s to this day, they didn't recognize Israel on the basis that they will recognize Israel only once the Palestinian state is also recognized. So this was a very pro-Palestinian country, and yet, over the last 10 years, ever since we went bankrupt, and
were tortured by Germans, right?
Yes, and you know, there is a connection here, but I'll come back to that connection. So the Greek state now is completely in the pocket of Israel. The Greek military is dependent on Israel for training, for equipment. The Israeli Air Force uses Greek airspace for vital to them training exercises because their own airspace is not large enough. And here in Greece, let me give you an example. My government here, not my government, but the government of the member state of Europe called Greece, of which I'm a citizen and proud of itself, has not remonstrated to the German authorities for violating European Union freedom of movement legislation and banning me from entering. So they've been complicit, the Greek government's been complicit. So no, it's not an outlier. It is the most idiotic application of ultra-Zionism because, you know, banning people from actually participating in a Zoom conference is a bridge too far. I think they've overreached. Now they realize that they've overreached. I can see that the German authorities, even though they're not backing down or backing off, they seem embarrassed by the lengths and depths of their own inanity.
And I wonder if this podcast will be banned in Germany.
Supposedly, you know, according to this, the original ban was called Betätigungsverbot, which is issued by the Federal Minister of the Interior, and effectively it bans a person and a person's activities in every shade or form. So according to that original decree against me, yes, if your podcast, this podcast, were to be reproduced in Germany by anyone, then they would be opening themselves up to prosecution. But interestingly, they realized that this Betätigungsverbot is utterly illegal in the European Union, so they've changed it. You see, I'm learning new German words now into an Einreisenverbot, which is a milder kind of verbot or ban, which doesn't necessarily involve podcasts, but it still bans Zoom and video link participation.
The EU is supposed to be about internationalism and the free movement of everything, people as well as capital, but apparently some ideas are not allowed to move freely in the EU.
Well, I think that this is gone now, Doug. These Europeanists, great supporters of the European project, used to imagine, celebrate the European Union as a peace project. But well before Russia invaded Ukraine, the European vision of a peaceful road to shared prosperity, which was the official mantra of the EU, had already begun to frazzle. And now we have the European Union's mutation into something that should be unrecognizable to the greater liberal supporters of the EU. And let me take you closer to our common interests in economics and finance. You will recall our discussions, 12 years ago?
It's been a while, yes.
Yeah, about my thesis, which was very simple. We have federal money, the euro. It's a kind of common federal money. And what I was saying to you on your program all those years ago was that unless we federate our fiscal powers, our powers to tax and to borrow and to spend, unless we have a Hamiltonian moment in American terms, then we're going to be in dire straits. And there were all these discussions and these policy papers that I was putting out for Eurobonds, the equivalent of U.S. Treasury bills, in order to bring together consolidation, to consolidate our debt, in order to consolidate our democracies, to consolidate our politics, purely Hamiltonian arguments. That all went by the by. It was all ignored. The European Union, in its infinite wisdom, allowed a very good crisis, the euro crisis, to go to waste and not use it as an excuse for federating, for creating these common instruments to consolidate, to create a process of continental consolidation. They just let all this go. And instead, they practiced huge austerity to keep together the euro area, the federal money, without any kind of political or fiscal federation. And yet now, only a month ago, the president of the European Union Council, a certain gentleman, a failed Belgian politician by the name of Charles Michel, came out and proposed a Eurobond out of the blue. You know, what I have been proposing now for two decades and more has come back as a proposal, but not in order to fund common health programs, education programs, and particularly the Green Transition, our equivalent IRA, which doesn't exist in the European Union, no, to fund a new European military-industrial complex, which, according to the president of the European Union Council, is going to become the engine of growth and technological progress of the European continent. So they retrieve the idea of the Eurobond. They will not do it because they're incompetent and because they don't want the political, democratic getting together consolidation that that would involve, but they still veer towards this narrative of getting together to fund a never-ending war. Because that, if you rely, as in the United States, on your military-industrial complex as the engine of growth, well, then you have to engineer a lot of wars in order to make sure that this engine of growth doesn't stall. So the original idea of the Europeanists, of the European Union project as a peace project, juxtaposed against the United States, which was always an imperialist force and so on, that is gone. That's gone, even according to the official version, according to what comes out of the horse's mouth in Brussels.
Okay, let's move on to an equally cheerful topic, techno-feudalism. So first, could you just give us a quick definition of what you mean by the term and why it's important?
The term is a repercussion of certain observations that have been hitting me one after the other over the last 7-8 years. My understanding of capitalism is, by the way, full disclosure, it's fully Marxist. I understand capitalism as a system of exploitation based on the marketization of labor and of capital and of money. So markets, unlike in feudalism, where most of productive activity was happening outside markets, there was no labor market. There was labor, but there was no market for labor. There was rent that was extracted by the feudal lords, courtesy of owning the land, and markets were peripheral. There were sideshows to that story. And capitalism was the great transformation of societies from societies where land ownership gave power to its owners to extract rents from the peasants, to a system where power sprang out of owning capital, that is, produced means of production, like steam engines, electricity grids, and so on. And that power allowed the accumulation of surplus value, part of which ended up in the pockets of the owners of these produced means of production, of capital, as profits. So profits and markets was capitalism. The observations that have led me to write techno-feudalism and to make the astonishing claim and the weird claim that capital has grown so toxic and so triumphant that it has actually killed its host, capitalism. And now it has begot capital. Capital itself has begot, through a mutation of it, to what I call cloud capital, to the capital that lives in your phone and in your laptop and on the supposed cloud, the proverbial cloud. It has given rise to a system where markets have been replaced by digital platforms, which are called cloud thieves, and profits have been replaced by a new form of ground rent, which are called cloud rent. And if I'm right in this hypothesis, then we have a weird kind of capital-based feudalism. It's a capital which is very different to every other kind of capital we had so far. It's not a produced means of production. It's a produced means of behavioral modification. This is a unique mutation of capital, which has destroyed capitalism and replaced it with what I call techno-feudalism, which is the realm of cloud capital. The cloudalists, the owners of cloud capital, who are, in my estimation, extracting already 30% of global GDP in the form of cloud rents. And together with the monies that have been printed by the G7's central banks, they have completely taken over from the standard capitalist dynamic based on the accumulation of surplus value through the ownership and the accumulation of produced means of production.
I saw that 30% figure you did in an interview with Wired, I believe it was. How do you arrive at that number? It seems very large.
The first thing you do is you identify the firms which are based on cloud capital. And these are, of course, the Magnificent Seven in your New York Stock Exchange, which, by the way, is the lion's share of the New York Stock Exchange. If you take those cloudless firms out, very little is left in terms of actual value circulating around the circuits of financial capital in the United States. If you add to these companies the smaller ones around Europe, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, of course, the great cloudalists in China, Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, all those companies which are the equivalent of Silicon Valley, of the big tech, of the Magnificent Seven, and you tot up the net revenues of all those, or even the revenues, you'll find that you end up with an astonishing percentage. I think that 30% may actually be an underestimate. Because, Doug, we must not forget that this kind of capital, which I call cloud capital, is so quantitatively different to traditional capital that we are talking about a qualitative change. Let me give you a specific number. If you take any of the old-fashioned conglomerates, capitalist conglomerates like General Electric, General Motors, British Aerospace, Volkswagen, and so on, 85% of their revenues go to salaries and wages. 85%. More or less. There is a homomorphism here. It's between 82 and 88%. When it comes to Facebook, for instance, or Google, it's less than 1% that goes to wages and salaries. The rest is rent. And mostly it is rent that you and I are producing. Not even the employees of those companies. That's why, you know, I call us, we are the producers, the direct producers of this cloud capital. Because every time you upload a post on Facebook or a video on TikTok, you are actually contributing directly to the cloud capital of those conglomerates. So they don't need wage labor because they have cloud serves. It doesn't matter whether you're doing it voluntarily or not. You are producing capital directly. That had never happened to, you know, steam engines when they had to be built, or electricity grids. The capitalists employed wage labor to do it. Now you don't have that. So, especially now with AI, turbocharging the power of cloud capital, I think we are going to be looking at a 40% of global GDP being siphoned off the circular flow of income in the form of what I call cloud rents.
We're listening to an interview with Yanis Varoufakis, author of Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, published by Melville House. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Son of Evil Spawn from Waxahachie's new album. And now the second part of my interview with Yanis Varoufakis, author of Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, published by Melville House. I was just looking at like the value-added numbers. The entire information sector in the U.S. is responsible for less than 2% of value-added, less than 1% of employment. Amazon has 1.5 million employees, so it's not exactly free from the old constraints of wage labor. And its total revenues are equal to about a week's U.S. retail sales. I feel like you're really exaggerating the significance of these firms as paradigms. When you look at them closely, they don't really seem all that exemplary of the way economic life is conducted today. Most people don't work in these kinds of institutions. You know, U.S. economy keeps adding 200,000, 300,000 employees a month, mostly in rather old kinds of fields. Just focusing on a couple of stars and drawing really heroic conclusions from them?
I don't believe so. In your estimation, for instance, in your own computation, where do you place Walmart? Because Walmart is increasingly moving to the cloud.
It does retail sales, though. They buy products cheaply and sell them more expensively, and they do a lot of that. So does, you know, Amazon. Amazon moves around. They've got warehouses all over, logistics. I remember when Amazon first started, they were going to do it without any kind of logistic infrastructure. Well, they found out that they needed it, and they became, in that sense, they have one foot in the very old economy of, you know, moving things around.
Of course they do. But that's like saying that capitalism needed a feudal sector that produced the food without which capitalism would not continue. Take Amazon, for instance, right? I mean, they are not producing anything. They are simply shifting stuff around. They charge anything between 15 and 40% of the price you pay on it. This is a form of ground rent. I call it cloud rent. How do you account for that in your statistics? Do you count it as profit? I don't.
Are you referring to the outside sellers?
Yes, of course. They are all outside sellers. 99% of what is being traded on the Amazon platform, on Alibaba, just like Airbnb, like Uber, they do not own the capital goods that produce the services and the goods that are being traded on them. They are charging a cloud rent.
Well, Amazon has, you know, giant warehouses, distribution centers, entire network of couriers, 1.5 million employees. I mean, that's not post-material in any sense.
Not in the slightest. This is the power of cloud capital. The way I see it is this. There is one piece of software, very complicated software, which is the Amazon algorithm. The same algorithm which trains us to train it, to train us to put good ideas into our mind as to what we should buy, books, music, electric bicycles, and so on, and which forms desires in our heads which make us buy from Amazon those goods. The same algorithm is controlling the workplace of the proletarians in the Amazon warehouses. It is the same algorithm that predicts in which warehouse there is an elevated probability of a trade union being formed, and therefore immediately it either fires workers or downplays the significance in the network of the company of that particular warehouse in order to prevent unionization. This is one algorithm. And as I said, it's a produced means of behavior modification. And that algorithm is what allows the accumulation of rents in Amazon. That, of course, is completely dependent on a capitalist sector being alive and kicking within the techno-feudal order. So if you want to say that the standard capitalist sector, the original capitalist sector, is absolutely essential for the techno-feudal order that I am describing, you are completely right. Let me put it in Marxist terms. In my book, which from my perspective is a fully Marxist political economy analysis, all surplus value, all exchange value, and therefore all surplus value, is produced in the traditional capitalist sector. But increasingly, and that's where the 30% figure comes from, 30% of value added, as you put it, is being siphoned off in the form of cloud capital by companies like Amazon, but not just Amazon. Increasingly, Tesla, for instance, I don't know whether you know that, but increasingly its revenues are coming not from selling cars, but from the data it collects in real time from drivers driving around in Tesla cars, because Elon Musk knows, not Elon Musk, but his algorithm knows, when you're driving his car to go to the supermarket, what did you actually buy in the supermarket? What music were you listening to before you got off in order to go to the supermarket to buy whatever it is? And increasingly, all this data is being utilized in order to train algorithms by Walmart. He sells his data to Walmart, for instance. So you can see that the two sectors, the capital sector and the techno-feudal sector, are absolutely intimately interrelated. But the point I'm making is, with the increasing replacement of actual markets with these digital platforms and the shift of value from the capital sector to the capitalists, you have, from a macroeconomic point of view, greater and greater instability, because aggregate demand falls in proportion to the increasing cloud rents, for reasons that David Ricardo has told us centuries ago. And if you add to that what's going on in the developing world, in Indonesia, I made this point in the book, you've got Jeff Bezos, not Amazon, but Jeff Bezos Enterprises, together with Peter Thiel and others, local Indonesian cloudalists or owners of cloud capital, who've purchased 3.5 million kiosks from around the countryside to financialize them and to incorporate them into their own version of cloud capital. This is already happening as we speak. If you look at WeChat, the app belonging to Tencent in China, you will find that a very substantial amount of value added, of surplus value in China, is by being siphoned off. And this is why President Xi has tried to put the lid on cloud capital, on cloud rent. And there is this apparent clash between the leadership of the Communist Party with the representatives of Chinese big tech. For me, unless we understand the encroachments of the techno-feudal order around the world, we do not understand what is going on, and especially we don't understand the new Cold War between the United States and China.
I want to return to that topic in a moment, but let's talk a moment about Tesla. Just like an hour before we started recording, it was announced that Tesla is going to lay off a tenth of its workforce. They have about 140,000 employees, which is not a trivial number. About a tenth of them are going to get laid off because of falling prices for electric vehicles and rising competition. That sounds like pretty much old-style capitalism to me. They're not operating in a world where all this information can deliver them from the realities of old-style competition.
Yeah, you're right. Tesla is on the cusp between, on the gray zone between the capitalist and the techno-feudal sector. No doubt about that. They are producing physical goods, like, you know, cars, their own cars, like Henry Ford was producing them. And they are subject to competition from BYD in particular in China. And, yeah, it's actually BYD. There's no doubt about that. I'm not arguing that the capitalist sector has gone away. What I'm saying, this is my controversial claim, that the cloudalist sector, the cloud capital sector, the techno-feudal sector, has already become dominant. And, you know, Elon Musk was always with one foot inside that camp of cloudalists. And this is, you've read the book, you know that this is an argument of mine, this is why he bought Twitter. Because he wasn't fully entrenched in this cloud capital. Twitter was his interface when he talked about turning it into an everything app. That's what he meant. But Jeff Bezos doesn't have this problem because Amazon is not in a capitalist competition with anybody else.
It's in competition with Walmart and Target.
Yeah, but that's not capitalist competition. This is rivalry. Because under feudalism, there was always a rivalry between fiefdoms. The point I'm making is this, that if you are already inside Amazon.com, if you have an account and so on, you may also be in another fief, but there is no direct competition within, you know, the two platforms are not competing with one another. They are using their tools in order to suck you in. So if you are selling stuff through Amazon, your business model is reliant on all the tools that Amazon has given you. And you can't simply, costlessly, go from there to Walmart. You can, but the switching costs are so high, they are reminiscent of the costs of upping stumps from one fiefdom and going to another fiefdom in medieval England.
What now, if I want to buy, you know, some lawn furniture for my very tiny backyard here in Brooklyn, I can go to Amazon, but I can also go to the Target, which is not that far away. I can go to Home Depot, which is also not that far away. I mean, there's just still an awful lot of competition in the retail space that for all the clever algorithms that Amazon can assemble and deploy, there's still a lot of very substantial real-world competition that, they're important. They're very important, but they're not dominant in the way you seem to want to argue.
Well, we have a different perception on this. The fact that you can doesn't mean that you do. And for the vast majority of people in the United States, in particular, these conglomerates have succeeded in spreading an aridity around themselves. So in many towns in the Midwest, here in Greece, you simply don't have an alternative. Maybe you can go from one platform to another, but most people don't. And if you look at the interoperability percentages, and this is empirical, real empirical data, there's very little. There is very little of the shopping around happening. Because once you are inside Amazon.com and you have paid for your Prime account and, you know, you're paying every month a fee for this, for that, or the other, people simply are locked in. And this is the beauty of it, because unlike feudalism, nobody forces you to. It's all voluntary. That's, you know, just this is a carryover from capitalism. Your slavery is volunteered.
Musk is an interesting character because, you know, he does operate in very physical industries. His firms build cars, they build rocket ships, they drill holes in the ground to make tunnels. And he's making a terrible mess of Twitter. He's not being very successful at that enterprise. He lives on Earth as well as the clouds.
Absolutely. He's the epitome of somebody who's got one foot on each boat.
That could be harmful in the long run.
Indeed. But he reminds me a lot of Thomas Edison, because if you've read The Currency Wars, Edison, who was a genius when it came to marketing himself, not so much inventing, but marketing himself on destroying his opposition and so on, the venom with which he tried to fight Westinghouse and alternative current, I can see Elon Musk in Thomas Edison. Remember the scene in Coney Island where he actually electrocuted that poor elephant?
Yeah, I saw that in college. I saw a cinema course in college. It's stuck with me ever since.
That's something Elon Musk could have done. And Thomas Edison blundered to a very large extent. He squandered many of his advantages. So, you know, but nevertheless, Thomas Edison does mark a significant transformation of capitalism from its early phase to its monopoly phase. Similarly, I think Elon Musk is a good marker for this transition to cloud capital, the transition to what I call techno-feudalism.
Time is running out. There are two more large topics I want to cover. One, you talk about this cloud capitalist as a new ruling class. But I don't really see these people articulating themselves that much with the political system. Their political contributions and lobbying are pretty minor compared to the size of some of these companies. The U.S. right is really driven and funded by, at least from the business side, by Koch Industries, private firms, private equity, moguls like the Ulines. I'm not seeing that these cloud capitalists are getting too deeply involved in the political system, joining the political class, or really, you know, interacting with the state. Well, the CHIPS Act is providing subsidies to Intel and the likes of that. But, you know, these cloud capitalists are not, I don't see them that politically active compared to many other industries.
They don't have to, Doug, because, you know, if you are a fossil fuel producer, you absolutely rely on the White House. The White House can, or the FTC or someone, can carry out very quickly some campaign which damages you inexorably. But as we know, the FTC has been trying to do something about the exorbitant power of Amazon and others, and they can't, because this is not Standard Oil. You know, Standard Oil technically could be broken up very, very quickly. The Koch brothers could be breaking up very quickly. Technically, politically, it's very hard. And that, why? Because they are spending all this money lobbying, and that's why they're doing it. But, you know, with Facebook, what do you do with Facebook? How do you break up Facebook? It simply cannot be done. And it would be crazy to break it up and to have a Facebook California and a Facebook New York, where the two do not communicate with one another. So that's my theory, at least, is this, that they are not doing that much lobbying because they don't need to. They have the algos. The algos are so powerful. And you know what? Remember the way in which the financial derivatives, the weapons of mass financial destruction, as Warren Buffett called them, remember that their complexity was their power? No one understood what was in there, not even the people who actually created them. And that was their strength. Because they were so opaque, they traded like hotcakes for a while, and then they were salvaged by Summers and Geithner after 2008, 2009. Similarly, the algorithms, especially now the AI-driven algorithms of Amazon, of Google, the people who actually program them do not know why those algorithms do what they do. So how can anyone regulate them? So unlike fossil fuels, and unlike, you know, the old-fashioned Koch brothers and so on, who need to have politicians in their pockets, the strength of the cloud capital of the techno-feudal lords is enough for them. Oh, by the way, let's not underestimate some of the moves they've already made. Who owns the Washington Post?
Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos. Peter Thiel, I know it from the inside, more or less. He's very active in promoting right-wing causes. You saw Elon Musk. Elon Musk is also engaged in politics. His position on Israel, his position on Donald Trump, now in Argentina with Milei, he's flexing his political muscles, but he doesn't need to do as much as the Koch brothers need.
You mentioned AI. The investment requirements for this stuff are enormous. Microsoft already has, 300 data centers or something like that around the world. They're building wind farms to power them. They're even talking about building a little nuclear power plant. The capital spending is enormous to develop this infrastructure. I mean, it all looks insubstantial and cloudy to us, but there really is, and not to mention all the hardware that goes into outfitting these things, that kind of disappears. I remember I wrote something long ago about information fetishism. Like, it's like a second order commodity fetishism. The relation between people is a relation between things and classic commodity fetishism, but then you add a layer of information on top of it, and all the social and physical relations disappear. But just looking at the cloud part, you're forgetting just how much physicality this depends on.
Well, I don't. I'm a materialist, and I've made it very clear in my book, right from the beginning, that cloud capital has nothing to do with the cloud. It's right on Earth. And it's all very material. I've been into a Microsoft server farm somewhere in Utah, and it's a humming, gigantic, soulless factory. There are very few workers in there, but when you're in there, you know that there's nothing cloudy about it. It's fully material. But what is fascinating, and I was alerted to that by somebody really very high up in Facebook, and I make a song and dance about this in my book. What is fascinating to me is that most of that cloud capital was financed through our central banks. After the 2009 bailouts, 9 out of 10 dollars that went into all this infrastructure, this materiality that you described of Facebook, came out of QE money. And that was related to me by somebody really very, very, very high up in Facebook. And then I started looking. And indeed, because if you think about it, from April 2009 to almost a year and a half ago, the central banks of the G7 produced about $35 to $36 trillion of QE money. They flooded the circuits of capital of the financial sector with it, while our governments were practicing austerity. So austerity killed real investment in traditional capital, in produced means of production. The money was being used in order to essentially finance share buybacks by most companies. So the stock exchanges were doing really very well, but investment was very tepid, except for cloud capital. The only capitalists who actually took that money from the banks, that took it from the Fed, from the European Central Bank, from the Bank of Japan, Switzerland, and so on, were, the Bezoses and the Zuckerbergs of the world, and Microsoft, of course. And they used state money, essentially, in order to build this huge quantity of very material cloud capital. I think this is really very interesting, because this is also not part of what you consider to be a traditional capitalist dynamic.
I totally agree with you on the QE question. I think people really underestimate the transformative power of that. Finally, though, we're running low on time, so I want to get to this. You analyze the increasing tensions between the U.S. and China as being a lot about cloud capital. Now, I see it as, one, the U.S. is fearing the rise of an imperial rival of a very old sort. Influence, real estate, military power, all those classic things about imperial rivalry. But also, a lot of it is centering on tech, but it's chip manufacturing. The U.S. seems to be very worried about China getting the capacity to produce really advanced electronics and trying to prevent it. We have the Biden administration subsidizing the U.S. chip industry. We're seeing an explosion in investment in chip production in the U.S. because of these subsidies. It's about the rivalry of hardware more, it seems to me, than it is about Alibaba versus Amazon.
I think it's neither. Neither Alibaba versus Amazon, nor hardware. The United States didn't give a damn about hardware being produced, including microchips, in China. The one thing that American administrators and decision makers understand, and they understand it independently of whether they are Republicans or Democrats, is the importance of maintaining the monopoly over the international payment system. Because as we know, the United States has been, since 1971, the breakdown of Bretton Woods, it has been increasing its hegemony in direct proportion to its deficits, which have been acting as a fantastic way of sucking into the territory of the United States both the net exports of everybody else, including China's, and something between 70 and 80% of the profits of the rest of the world's capitalists. That's how America has been becoming increasingly hegemonic after the end of the Bretton Woods system. So suddenly they have a problem with China building up its military. China is not even building up its military that significantly. That didn't bother the Clinton administration, didn't bother the Obama administration. Suddenly it's only in the last 7-8 years when cloud capital has emerged. But it's not because Alibaba is threatening Amazon. No. If you want to know what it is that they are really very worried about, it is, I mentioned it, WeChat. WeChat is an application owned by Tencent, which allows the Chinese, or anybody, you can have an app as long as you're happy to transact in one in the Chinese currency, and you can make a payment to anybody at no fee. That is a complete disaster for Wall Street. Wall Street would never allow Apple and Google and Big Tech, American cloud capital, to take away its capacity to charge, to extract financial rents. So the United States does not have the capacity to merge its cloud capital with Wall Street. The Chinese have done that through WeChat, and not only through WeChat, but we have the new digital currency by the Central Bank of China. So I know people in Germany, German businessmen, who are trading with China and who have skipped out of the dollar payment system, out of the European Central Bank, out of the Buddhist Bank. They're using WeChat and they use the digital currency of China. Suddenly, people in Washington who understand realize that there is an alternative to the dollar payment system. And that to them is a clear, it's an existentialist threat to American hegemony. This is why they are trying to deny. First, it was Trump that banned Huawei. That was the first step. But then Joe Biden came in and to confirm the bipartisanship in this attempt, banned importation into China or export to China of high-quality chips. Why? Because they're scared of the evolution and the improvements in the payment system using cloud capital, the merged cloud capital and financial capital of China, which can never be replicated in the United States, not because the United States doesn't have the technology, but because Wall Street will never allow its banking monopoly to be diluted into the cloud capital of the West Coast.
Anxieties about the replacement of the dollar's role as the world's central currency, I mean, they've go back decades, and there are many, many dimensions to it, much larger than cloud capital. For example, you know, there's no treasury market for people to park a lot of money in China. The Chinese wouldn't want it. A lot of the Chinese elite seems to be very reluctant to open up that much, open up its financial markets to the foreign influence. So it's really, it seems much less a matter of technology than politics and relative economic power.
I will insist in my thesis, and let me tell you why. You are completely right. The thing that has been holding back the Chinese alternative payment system is Chinese capitalists.
Oops, I lost you.
The development of the Chinese payment system is Chinese capitalists who, as you correctly say, they do not want to use it. They prefer the dollar system. So Chinese traditional capitalists, that is, you know, aluminium producers or traditional car manufacturers, they want their money in dollars because they want the American dollar for the fundamental reason that the American trade deficit is what creates demand for their goods. So, you know, the Chinese alternative payment system wouldn't get anywhere if it was just that. But the war in Ukraine, by seizing $450 billion of Russian central bank money, has created an interest, not so much by the Chinese, but by German producers, by Saudi Arabians, who start feeling, when the Americans didn't like Putin's oligarchs, they seize their money. Maybe they will seize our money if they don't like us tomorrow. So they started hedging their bet.
That was Yonas Varoufakis, author of Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, published by Melville House. Apologies for the abrupt ending, but Zencastr, the platform I used to record these interviews, started failing, which it rarely does. We're about out of time anyway, but an elegant conclusion would have been nicer. One advantage of doing one's own show is getting the last word. First, about Yonas's claims that U.S.-China tensions are driven by the threat the digital yuan presents to the dollar's preeminent international role. I've covered this several times in the show, And these anxieties seem overblown. China has nothing like the deep financial markets that make the U.S. dollar attractive to foreign holders. There's nowhere big players can park spare cash, and it's likely to be a long time before there is. This seems more like a great power rivalry to me. More generally, I'm skeptical at the emergence of the digital monsters Yannis focuses on market systemic change, even if they change the way we live, as did television once upon a time. He writes in the book, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk were able to build their super expensive, ultra-powerful cloud capital without needing to do any of the three things that capitalists traditionally had to do to expand: borrow money from some bank, sell large portions of their businesses to others, or generate large profits to pay for new capital stock. In fact, they share the business with public stockholders, and they both have large debt. Plus, they generate profits with which they fund physical investments. That sounds like a very incomplete departure from tradition. Yannis says the cloud sector rests on a foundation of classic capitalism, but if that realm is where over 90% of employment and value added reside, then it seems odd to promote the cloudalists to exemplary status. It's interesting how two of the leaders of this cloud world, Google and Meta, have had difficulties moving beyond their original businesses. That suggests to me that they may be more anomalous than exemplary. They are remarkably profitable, yes, to the tune of about $500,000 per employee last year, but ExxonMobil makes even more. And there aren't many companies like Google or Meta, either. Amazon extracts a more ordinary $20,000 in profit per employee, but that's about a third of what the ultimate old-line firm, General Motors, makes. And poor Elon's Tesla stock is down by about two-thirds from its November 2021 peak, 13% in just the past week, as the severity of its competitive challenges have come clear. All the data snooping in the world won't make much money if Tesla can't sell cars. As for political engagement, Yannis has a point about Thiel, but he is one force among many, even if you limit your sample to the right. This crowd is a long way from becoming a new ruling class, and the contempt among many of them for government isn't going to grease their entry into the realm of the political elite. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, an artifact of the late 1990s tech mania, The Age of Information by Momus. Till next week, bye.
This is a public service announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now entering the age of information. It's perfectly safe if we all take a few basic precautions. May I make some observations? Axiom 1, from the world we've become, your reputation used to depend on what you concealed. Now it depends on what you reveal. The age of secretive mandarins who creep on hills of tact is dead. We're all players now in the great game of fact instead. So since you can't keep your cards to your chest, I'd suggest you think a few moves ahead, as one does when playing a game of chess.